This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the voters have spoken. What lies ahead for Michigan's Republican Party?
So I think internally we will have a fairly robust debate whether, you know, we should be more conservative, less conservative, more philosophical, less philosophical.
And Michigan Democrats?
Democrats have to do some soul searching, too. They had wins yesterday and they had losses.
And who spent all that money trying to win your vote?
People don't write 5-, 6-, 7-figure checks for selfless reasons. They have an agenda in mind.
Plus, praise for small-town living.
Every time I would come home, I would start to see things at home that I was seeing in those big cities.
Those stories and much, much more. But first, the news. This is Stateside, and I'm Cynthia Canty. Welcome. Well, you spoke in Michigan. The lines were often long at the polls all through our state. And today we know Michigan voters said yes to Barack Obama and Debbie Stabenow. You voted down all the ballot proposals, and you said no to the state's controversial emergency manager law. On today's show, we'll look at the massive amount of money that was spent in so many of these races. We'll speak with a top Republican and a top Democrat about what both parties need to do going forward in Michigan. But first, let's dig deeper into the election results from all around the state as we welcome Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi, and Bill Ballinger, editor and publisher of Inside Michigan Politics.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, the big question, did you guys get any sleep last night?
A little.
Election night for political reporters is a little bit like going to a New Year's Eve party. You have a pretty strong expectation of how you're going to feel the next day.
Well, I'm glad you took time to talk with us today. I want to start with the reelection of Barack Obama, Michigan continuing its pattern of choosing a Democrat for the White House. Bill, was it the auto industry bailout narrative that did in Mitt Romney?
That was part of it, but you got to remember, again, it's been said ad nauseum on your program and others, the Republicans have not won a presidential contest since 1988 in Michigan. So it's not like Republicans were coming into 2012 with a head of steam, even though maybe they thought they were based on the results 2 years ago, which was a non-presidential year. So I think there were a lot of things conspiring against whoever the Republican nominee turned out to be in Michigan. But certainly Romney's New York Times editorial 4 years ago, and to me, his inability to really put that to rest and to get it off the table as an issue, that really just caused him continuous problems.
Yeah, Mitt Romney's explanation on where he stood on the automotive rescue was sort of analogous to John Kerry's position on the Iraq War. I was against it before I was for it.
Right, right. You know, we've heard that a lot.
Well, it he was just never able to square it with people, which was a big deal in Michigan. And also Republicans kind of overestimated the power of the Romney name in a race here, that they really thought that, you know, Romney would be seen as kind of a hometown guy that they would want to send to the White House, and that turned out not to be the case. I think a lot of the attention, the little bit of attention that Michigan got, and the second tier attention that Michigan got, was for Mitt Romney a lot more about protecting his national narrative, that to not look like he wasn't trying to play in Michigan, to not look like John McCain did in 2008 when he famously withdrew from the state. But I think that was for appearances to the rest of the country more than making a serious play here.
Let's move over to the race for U.S. Senate. Debbie Stabenow soundly beating Pete Hoekstra. Is that because Stabenow is a good candidate, or was it more because Pete Hoekstra didn't run a good campaign? Yes to both?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, that, Debbie Stabenow is an amazing campaigner that, her opponents would certainly, her prior opponents would certainly testify to that. But, Pete Hoekstra never really recovered from, you know, his very first blunder, which was the Super Bowl ad that depicted the actor playing a Chinese woman on a bicycle. It was widely panned. Some people called it racist, and he just was never able to recover from that. He, you know, was able to win his primary without a particularly strong challenge, and then just got blown away in the general.
Let's talk get your thoughts on the close congressional districts, which would be, we think, 1, 3, and 11. Bill?
Well, the first congressional district really was the only race that should have been close, and it was. The incumbent freshman Republican Dan Benischek held on by a very narrow margin. Only by about 1% did he beat Gary McDowell, the former state representative who was his opponent 2 years ago and whom Benischek beat easily in 2010. In the third district, Justin Amash, who is a kind of renegade Tea Party / libertarian Republican who's rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, the Democrats thought they had a shot at was Steve Pesca, who is a former state representative and former judge. The problem is that district is about the second most Republican district in the entire state. So I never thought it really was going to be in play, and it wasn't. Amash won by about 9%. And, of course, then there's the famous 11th district, scene of the Thaddeus McCotter petition fraud fiasco. And we ended up with Kerry Benevolio, the reindeer rancher and Santa Claus impersonator as the Republican nominee.
And for that,
nominee.
We'd like to say thank you.
And Dr. Syed Taj, who is a physician, Canton Township trustee, but for what it's worth, a very liberal candidate, a big supporter of Obamacare and very outspoken on a lot of issues in a district which was made about 56-57% Republican, almost as much as Amash's. And so the idea that Taj was really a good fit for that district, just because people didn't like Benevolio, that didn't work either. So Benevolio ended up winning pretty easily by about 7%. So the delegation is going to be 9-5 Republican, which is exactly the way the Republicans drew up the map.
And you know, Bill nailed it on the 11th district that, you know, Michigan Democrats were very frustrated that the National Party, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, didn't put more resources into that race because they thought they had a vulnerable Republican there. But, you know, the national poobahs looked at that, said no way, and turned their attention elsewhere.
Rick, I want to talk state house. Republicans keep the house. Jace Bulger survives as speaker. So what does this mean for the Republicans going forward for the next 2 years in Lansing and also for Governor Snyder?
Well, I mean, you know, basically, you know, what we saw was, you know, an affirmation of the status quo, you know, all the way up and down the ballot. And, you know, we'll see that Democrats really targeted the speaker and spent a lot of money, maybe even a lot of money that could have been spent winning other seats and closing that margin, but really tried to make it a race about Jace Bulger. And we'll see what that does to the demeanor of the House in the coming months and the next couple of years. And you know, they came close. That's a 57% Republican district. And Jace Bulger won by about 800 votes. That's not a comfortable margin in a place like that.
I want to talk about Proposal 1, the referendum on the emergency manager law. Where do both of you see this going now? Because I know I heard the governor say, well, we'll revert to the Emergency Financial Manager Act and others.
We already have, actually.
But are there not court challenges?
There are court challenges that it's a hyper-technical legal argument about what happens when a law is repealed. If there is a repealer in it, does that mean that the old law just comes back into effect? That's what Governor Snyder and Attorney General Bill Schuette are arguing. Or does it just disappear, evaporate like it never was? And that's what opponents of emergency managers are arguing, and they have filed lawsuits. The governor, we talked to him this morning, and he said that uh, for for the moment, the state is going to continue as if the Emergency Financial Manager Law, Public Act 72, is the one that's in effect. And if it gets struck down in court, then, they might do something. That what they're largely concerned with is making sure that municipal bankruptcy doesn't become a serious prospect.
Bill, I want your thoughts. Proposals 2 through 6 slam dunked right down the drain by Michigan voters.
Well, I guess it proves the rule, and we ought to be happy about this. Money doesn't necessarily buy everything. Because these proposals didn't just lose, they got killed. And particularly Proposal 6, where Matty Maroon had to spend $30 million plus, and he just got waxed. So, I think, frankly, not only the politicians and Governor Snyder in particular, but the citizens of the state ought to breathe a sigh of relief that none of these proposals got put in the Constitution. That wasn't the place for them. I think that was the message the public sent loud and clear. And about Proposal 1, I'll just say, I think, the Republican legislature and the governor are going to go pass something else to replace this. They're going to fix it. That's what they're going to do.
Yeah, I wonder if these ballot questions didn't, at least in part, get crushed under the weight of how many there were on the ballot, that people just looked at them all and said, never mind, and just sort of made a decision to vote no on Moss.
Well, I wouldn't say that's necessarily true, because we've had other years where we've had as many as 6. In 2002, we had 6. 1996, we had 6. And I got to tell you, 3 decades ago, I know this was long before either one of you were born.
Oh, I remember, you're so kind.
we had 10 and 11 proposals on ballots at that time, and people picked and chose, and they passed some and rejected others. I think there was a theme in a lot of the advertising this year, pretty much, that basically said, a plague on all your houses, just vote no. And I think that psychology worked.
Indeed, and it just goes to show every election is different.
Exactly.
Bill and Rick, always a pleasure talking with both of you. It's time for some sleep.
Not quite,
but approaching soon, hopefully.
Bill Ballinger, editor and publisher of Inside Michigan Politics, and Rick Pluta, the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. And for plenty more election results, including the race for state Supreme Court, you can head over to our website, michiganradio.org. And that's where we want to hear from you. Please connect with us. You can find us at michiganradio.org or go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still to come, money and lots of it pumped into the races all across the state. We'll talk about the effects of millions and millions of dollars coming up in 10 minutes. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, there's no doubt this has been a bruising campaign on both the state and national levels. So on this day after, the question is, what's ahead for the Democratic and Republican parties? And can citizens dare hope for an easing of these partisan tensions? Joining us now is Saul Anuzis, former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, and Debbie Dingell, president of D2 Strategies and a Democratic National Committee woman. Saul, let's start with you. There was a lot of support for Democrats, Stabenow and Obama, and yet in the congressional and House districts, Michigan voters were leaning Republican. How do you interpret that vote?
Well, I think, first of all, Michigan voters are very independent. Obviously, it was a good evening for the Democrats, not only statewide, but nationally. But at the same time, as you said, in many of the congressional districts, the Republicans held on to very tightly contested seats. They held on to the state House, which was a big target of the Democrats. The Speaker held on to his seat, which they went after very directly. And so, I think Michigan continues to have its kind of independent streak. They vote for the person more than the party necessarily. They're very concerned about the issues. And, you take a look at all the ballot initiatives going down. I mean, I think that part of that was that there was a lot of confusion with respect to those ballots, and yet people didn't want to mess with our Constitution. So we're still kind of one of those purple states that tend to vote Democrat on a national level and split their votes on the state level.
And Debbie, your view from the Democratic side?
Well, I agree with most of what Saul said. Michigan voters are independent. I also think Michigan citizens want to see Democrats and Republicans work together more. I think Governor Snyder is trying to do that. I believe that post-election, the interpretation of what the defeat of all of these ballot proposals means is going to be very important. So, for instance, Proposal 1, which actually repealed the emergency financial manager, was a signal to people in Lansing that they weren't happy with some of the legislative activity they did. You may see, if they're unsatisfied with further partisan legislative action in Lansing, an effort to repeal it on the ballot again.
What do you see for going forward and trying to work together? Debbie?
Well, I think President Obama has the responsibility to try to reach out across the aisle and work with Democrats and Republicans in both the House and Senate and try to bridge that divide more. I think on the Republican side, you quite literally had a Republican leader in the United States Senate who repeatedly said that he was more interested in making sure that President Barack Obama did not get reelected than in finding consensus on anything. Well, he got reelected. So I hope we can start to move forward with how do we find a consensus agenda. We've got very serious issues. We've got budget issues. We're looking at sequestration. If sequestration occurs, what it will do to so many things that Republicans and Democrats care about deeply is terrifying. And I hope that people will make a better effort to work across the aisle, which, by the way, does happen. Saul and I are very good friends. We have members of Congress that do work across the aisle, and I think voters have to hold their electeds accountable and tell them that's what they want.
Saul, I'd like your thoughts, too.
Well, I would agree. I think that part of the process and part of the challenge for us is that we can find consensus, but that doesn't necessarily mean we're all going to agree on things. And so the challenge for us becomes agreeing on the things that we agree to agree with, so to speak, and then respectfully agreeing to disagree on those issues that divide us. And so I think we can move a lot of things forward. But there are some very different philosophical divides with respect to taxes, with respect to spending, and a lot of other issues. And so we're going to have to figure out a way to not necessarily try to blackmail one another into, you know, I won't support this position unless you support that position. And there's always going to be horse trading. But if you're really going to move forward in a bipartisan manner, I think first we have to say, you know, what are the items that we can find common ground on? Where do we have real consensus? And move those items forward. And I think there's a lot of them. Even, you know, when you took a look at Obamacare, I mean, a lot of the issues within Obamacare had bipartisan support. They weren't looking for necessarily the bipartisan support. It was the decision to move it in a partisan manner. Mm. And so the few issues that divided us made it very partisan, very difficult, versus trying to pull people together on the issues that we agreed on that were, you know, common ground.
Let me shift us back to a state question. Saul, I want to ask you this. With Proposal 2 and Proposal 4 both resoundingly defeated, do you see that could embolden Republicans in the legislature to go forward with right-to-work legislation?
Well, I think right-to-work has constantly been, you know, on the agenda here in Michigan and probably will remain on the agenda for a long time. I mean, I personally think it's a good idea, but I wouldn't read too much into these, you know, ballot proposals. When you take a look at the fact that almost all of them went down by a 2-to-1 margin, to me that was more of a consensus that we didn't want to mess with the Constitution, that there was enough confusion out there. So I'm not sure it emboldens anybody, or if it does, it may be a false emboldenment, but I do think that right to work will be an issue that will continue to be a major factor in creating jobs in Michigan. So I think it's an issue that ought to be addressed.
Debbie?
I am concerned that right to work will tear us apart as a state. I think the working men and women of this state have been the backbone. I have participated in task force and studies which show that the state is competitive. There is a fallacy that our labor rates are not competitive. So I'm pleased to hear Saul say that people should not overread this, and I hope we don't see right to work in the state legislature tearing us apart, but that we keep moving forward, business and labor working together as they did when the auto industry was in crisis, to show people that this state is a competitive place to do business.
And finally, we've got now 2 years until the next election. What do both of you think the political talk in Michigan will be about over the next 24 months? Saul?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, obviously the Republicans have kind of some soul searching to do. There were some interesting losses around the country. You know, the Republicans are still trying to find their way, so to speak, I think, in a lot of different ways. And the demographics are moving against us with respect to a larger percentage of minorities voting, whether it's the African-American community or the Hispanic community. We did not do very well amongst women. We didn't do that well amongst young voters. And so I think we do have to take a look at how do we appeal to that different demographic and where the Republican Party goes in the future. So I think internally we will have a fairly robust debate whether, you know, we should be more conservative, less conservative, more philosophical, less philosophical. So that will be very interesting, and I think that will dominate a lot of the internal discussions. Externally, you know, this is where Debbie and I agree. I mean, whether you're Republican or Democrat, you want Michigan to come back. You know, we were a great state. We can be a great state again. We're slowly moving back in the right direction, whether it's the auto industry or all the other great industries that Michigan has. And so we are going to be looking for common ground amongst Republicans and Democrats. And there is a large percentage that wants to work together. There is a percentage that does not want to work together. There's a percentage that wants to make everything a partisan battle. That's going to be a big challenge for those of us who want to see Michigan move forward, who want to find that common ground and make sure that, you know, our state is a great state that our children and grandchildren can stay in and live in rather than have them move somewhere else to find a job.
And Debbie?
It's going to scare people that are listening to us today. Maybe so, and I need to bring people together across the state. Democrats have to do some soul-searching, too. They had wins yesterday, and they had losses. There were a number of state legislative seats that were very close, and had resources been put into those races instead of some other things, where would they actually be as they go into the next legislative session? So you'll see some soul-searching among Democrats about the directions that we're going, what are the issues that we care about, what are our priorities, how do we ensure that we as a party are reflective of the diversity of the state, that we're bringing young people in, a number of issues like that. But we, too, need to move forward working with everybody to continue to make this state competitive. And I will tell you one other issue that I hope my friend Saul is going to work with me on that he did work on 8 years ago, which is to change the presidential nominating system. Because we've seen battleground states where these candidates lived the last few months, Ohio, Florida, Colorado, Virginia, those states, President Obama and Governor Romney knew the issues that mattered in those states cold. And we believe that every state in the country should have the opportunity to start being one of those battleground areas that candidates start to campaign on. New Hampshire and Iowa, already they're talking about which candidates are going to start going there. We think every state in the country should have the opportunity to be one of those states in some kind of rotation, and I hope Republicans and Democrats work together to change the presidential nominating system for the next election.
Thank you both so much for your time. Thank you for talking with us, Saul and Debbie.
Thank you.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Saul Anuzis is former chairman of the Michigan Republican Party, and Debbie Dingell is president of D2 Strategies and a Democratic National Committee woman. Let's move now to the topic of money, lots of money, pumped into races all over Michigan, especially the ballot proposals. Joining us now to talk about those millions and millions and millions of dollars and what they did or didn't buy is Michigan Radio's Lester Graham, our Michigan Watch investigative reporter, and Rich Robinson, director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Rich, is there a fairly solid, reliable estimate as to just how much was spent on the campaigns to add those five amendments to the Michigan Constitution?
Well, the total was $152 million, and that number includes $5 million for what would have been Proposal 7, the casino gaming thing. So if you back that out of it, it was somewhere $146, $147 million. Proposal 2 alone was $55 million this time around. So that's California scale for spending on a ballot question. Just a tremendous amount of money was burned on these ballot questions.
And there we are, voters soundly smacking down Proposals 2 through 6. Lester, did that amount of money spent on those campaigns jive with the results?
You know, I was talking to John Bebo at the Center for Michigan last night, and he did not have Rich's numbers. I imagine he'll be surprised that it's as high as Rich is saying today. But even at that, he was saying this shows you can't buy the Michigan voters. It's simple. They'll do their homework when they need to, and they did. You know, I can't tell you how many people I heard poring over all the information they could get, not just yesterday and the day before, but weeks in advance because they really were confused by the ballot initiatives. I'm heartened by that, but also a little surprised because so many people just go in and say, oh, there's a proposal. I think the fact that there were so many people thought, oh, wow, I better bone up on this or I'm going to be lost. I'm wondering what's going to be happening next. A lot of people were concerned about the ease of amending the Constitution. I mean, we've done it some 30 times in the past, mm-hmm. but I think getting hit with all these five proposals at one time kind of made people think, do we really want to be able to amend the Constitution that easily? The governor has already suggested that maybe we shouldn't allow people to be paid to gather signatures, you know, and I don't think neither Prop 5 nor Prop 6, the bridge question and the two-thirds majority, would have gotten on the ballot without these paid signature gatherers, and probably the case for a couple of the other proposals as well.
Well, I think the situation is certainly 5 and 6 would have never been able to get the signatures without paid gatherers. I think what the governor is talking about is payment by the piece, payment per signature as opposed to payment by the hour. I don't think you can ban payment altogether. And the thing that should be borne in mind when considering that kind of an approach is Proposal 1 and Proposal 2 essentially relied on volunteer signature gatherers from the union organizations. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to affect that kind of movement at all with that approach. So I'm not sure what gets around it. I think one important thing is that the nonprofit corporations that are involved in gathering the money for these enterprises need to be ventilated as far as where are they getting their money. So Proposal 4 was essentially a corporate shell around SEIU money, mm-hmm. mostly SEIU money.
And just for everybody, just to remind them, SEIU is?
Service Employees International Union. And if the casino measure had gotten on the ballot, every bit of money it had raised came in through a nonprofit shell. We don't know any of the individuals who were behind that initiative. So that part of transparency is very important going forward for knowing who really is behind these things.
Because that dark money issue really concerns you, doesn't it, Rich?
It absolutely does. Close to three-quarters of the money in the Michigan Supreme Court campaign is dark money. We had an Oakland County Circuit Court race that had $2 million of dark money. It was all through these ballot initiatives, literally hundreds of millions, not traceable to any donor in federal campaigns, and certainly tens of millions in Michigan election campaigns.
Yeah, I've got one observation about that, and that is, you know, Rich and I did a series of stories at the beginning of the year talking about money and politics. I really thought people would be interested in that topic, want to know more about it. And basically, it was shrugged off. Huh, politics and money, who would have figured? And I think until the citizens of this state start realizing that while they weren't bought by these proposals, mm-hmm. some of their candidates are getting a lot of money that is off the books. And I don't mean personally. I mean mm-hmm. in their campaigns or on their behalf, I should say.
Right.
And that is going to influence how we are governed. I think that's a big concern. I think we have to shrug off this indifference about politics and money. Huh, who would have thunk? And really get concerned about this and do something, call for some action, call for some transparency.
I'll say this. People don't write 5-, 6-, 7-figure checks for selfless reasons. They have an agenda in mind, and it's important, I think, for the citizens to know where that money's coming from to understand what the agenda is.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Rich Robinson, director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, and Lester Graham, our investigative reporter here at Michigan Radio, talking about the money pumped into the race. Let's talk a little about Matty Maroon, Prop 6, he pumped in about $33 million is what I've seen. Is that about accurate? It's a lot of money trying to block that bridge. Voters really smacked that down. Now, do either of you expect more fighting from the Maroons? There was some kind of a statement in essence saying we're going to watch and make sure that not one penny of taxpayer money goes into that second bridge. Are they ready to lay down their arms or are they going to keep fighting? He's got deep pockets.
Matty Maroon's not going anywhere. He's going to continue the fight one way or the other. I don't know what that will be. I suspect a lawsuit of some kind will be his next move. But he's not giving up. He's not the kind of guy who walks away from a fight.
I think that's right. I think the reality here is time is money. And the longer he can filibuster the construction of the new bridge, the longer he can collect monopoly rents at that bridge crossing, the most important commercial international crossing in North America. So I, you know, whether it's litigation going forward or whatever it is, the longer he can delay it, the longer he collects monopoly rents.
What do both of you see as the takeaway now that we're sitting here the day after Election Day about money and politics in a broad, broad picture? I'm going to start with Rich because I know that's your mission.
it is. And I'll say this. Personally, I don't think it's healthy to allow interest groups and individuals to spend without limit, but the Supreme Court's made a statement about that. But the one thing that we do have to look forward to is transparency as far as money and politics goes. And I think the citizens of this state need to pursue it either by leaning on this legislature or getting organized and taking it on.
Lester, last word?
I just think it's going to take a while, and I'm not sure who's going to lead the initiative because this is not a partisan issue, and it's going to require a grassroots effort to get an initiative on the ballot. That takes money regardless, and certainly none of these folks who are handling dark money are going to contribute to that cause. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, I'm optimistic that somebody will pick up the ball and run with it, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Rich Robinson is the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Lester Graham is the Michigan Watch investigative reporter for Michigan Radio. Still to come, what can you find living in a small town that you might not find in the bright lights of a big city? We'll find out in 5 minutes here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When Barack Obama was first elected to the White House 4 years ago, there was a lot of talk of this being a post-racial era. With an African-American as president, the thinking went, we would enter an era of new attitudes between black and white Americans. But an Associated Press poll that's just been completed has found that racial attitudes have not improved. The study's authors came from the University of Chicago, Stanford University, and our next guest from the University of Michigan, Communication Studies Professor Josh Pasek. Now, let's start with the findings of your study, Josh, and then move to how it fits into President Obama's reelection. You found out not only have racial attitudes towards African Americans not improved, they actually got worse?
Yeah, so what we ended up finding was that there was an increase in the proportion of Americans who held net anti-black attitudes. And so it suggested that over the course of President Obama's term, things actually got a little worse. Now, there are a bunch of reasons to think this might be the case. And,
yeah.
And mind you, this is speculation.
Sure.
We can't tell you sort of exactly this is what happened
here. Right. But what are your senses?
But it's quite possible that a lot of people who didn't like many of the policies that the president was advocating interpreted some of those policies through a racial lens. And so you can imagine that if somebody, for instance, sees health care as a highly racial issue, and there's some evidence that a lot of people saw the benefits of health care going more to particular races than to others or thought that would be the case, that under those kinds of circumstances, you could end up in an environment where people sort of read some additional racial animosity into the policies and end up feeling some additional racial animosity themselves.
So here we are. Let's talk about what everyone's talking about, and that is Barack Obama's reelection. So you find racial tension, yet not only did we elect him once, but we as a nation doubled down. We elected him to a second term, and we will have a black family again living in the White House, really a symbol to the world of what America is about. So help us understand this dynamic.
Well, the thing is, racial attitudes, fortunately, in the present day, aren't the only thing that people make their decision on. And it's really good to know that even if we're finding that a large portion of Americans have net anti-black attitudes, there's still this potential that they can look at all the other issues out there and choose a candidate based on something else. And the fact is, somebody having some level of prejudice doesn't mean they can't behave in a way that seems to oppose that. And so we see that President Obama has impressively overcome that animosity, which is a really good sign for the country, even though it's not such a good sign that that animosity is still there.
Is there something going on with this reelection that deep down as you find, we are still a racially divided country, and that maybe for some voters, voting for a black president is kind of doing their bit to end racism, but deep down those feelings are still there?
Almost certainly. You know, we've seen in a bunch of studies coming out of psychology in particular in the last couple decades that there hasn't necessarily been an elimination of anti-black attitudes, but their form has changed. And that when we're looking at those kinds of things, there are decisions that people make that they're not even aware of. A bunch of sociologists, for instance, have sent out resumes with stereotypically white and stereotypically black names. Mm-hmm. And if you send out a resume with a stereotypically black name on it, it turns out the person is somewhat less likely to get the job. Mm-hmm. And so the processes that are going on are processes that quite possibly those people considering the resumes aren't actually thinking about, but that can still matter. And there's other evidence that in line with what you're suggesting could provide sort of extra challenges, which are that when people are given an opportunity to say, well, I've done a good thing in X, Y, or Z arena, they'll sometimes end up feeling more justified to do something that goes against that. It's this whole, well, I have some black friends phenomenon that allows one to presumably make some racist statement. And that really isn't, you know, a good direction per se, but there are people who internally feel like, well, they've justified their self-concept of themselves, and so this other area may not.
Josh Pasek, his research indicating racial attitudes toward African Americans have worsened since the election of President Barack Obama. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
And Josh Pasek is Communication Studies Professor at the University of Michigan. You could make a pretty strong case Americans tend to have a love-hate relationship with small towns. For every story, song, or play portraying small towns as pleasant, safe, and sheltering, there's another one that paints them as restrictive, stifling, even cruel. Many a young person has dreamed of getting themselves to a big city just as soon as they can. But can that small town exert a pull that can grab someone and bring them back from the glamorous big city life? Mickey Maynard recently wrote about her journey from small town to glamorous big cities and back again to her hometown of Ann Arbor. Mickey, your story in the AtlanticCities.com is entitled In Praise of Smaller Cities. Do you think small towns and cities need some defending?
I was like everybody else when I was growing up. I wanted to get out of here as fast as I could. The first step was going to Michigan State for undergrad. The second step after that was heading out east. I went to Washington. I went to New York. I just thought, I'll never live back in Michigan again if I can help it.
And that was because?
Well, I think part of it is I grew up in an airline family. We traveled all the time. My dad brought home the New Yorker, and I would sit on the living room floor looking at the cartoons and then gradually reading the articles and the ads in the back. And to me, there was nothing more glamorous as a big city with the tall buildings and the lights, and I thought much more sophisticated people and a way of life that I would never have found here.
So over how many years were you living the big city life?
Well, actually, my first big city was Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. When I was 19, I went to be an intern in the White House.
Well.
And so that was the introduction right there. And then as soon as I left, I would say I was about 25 when I moved to Washington for the first time. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a back and forth, back to Michigan, to the East Coast. I actually made it as far as Tokyo for a little while. I've lived in Chicago. And every time I would come home, I would start to see things at home that I was seeing in those big cities. And it struck me that either they were there and I just overlooked them, or I was learning, living in a big city, the skills that would make me more comfortable in a smaller city life.
So what were those things that you started saying, hey, wait a minute, it's here and there?
Well, all my friends know that I'm very interested in the local food movement. And I have always been someone who grew things in the backyard. My dad grew tomatoes and herbs and flowers, of course. And I've always been someone who went to farmers markets. So when I would come to Ann Arbor on the weekend, I'd always go to the farmers market. And when I lived in a big city. In New York, I would go to the Greens Market in Union Square. In Washington, we had local farmers markets in parking lots. And what I'd find was I was paying $1 or $2 more for a basket of strawberries than I would pay back in Michigan. And maybe the tomatoes that I liked weren't there, or the basil that I could get for Big Arm for $2 would cost me $10. So that was the first thing. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing was architecture. I am always been huge architecture fan. I took a great architecture class at Columbia University. And I started to look around the Midwest and see some of the same architecture that I was seeing in the slides in the dark in New York City.
Now, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Not skyscrapers so much.
Not skyscrapers so much, because it's kind of interesting. Even small cities always have one tall building. But some of the residential architecture, the Midwest is a fabulous has fabulous examples of Frank Lloyd Wright. The Midwest has fabulous examples of Louis Sullivan, Daniel Burnham. I found out that Belle Isle Park was designed by Olmsted, who designed Central Park. And so I think we do tend to have kind of a big city prejudice that only the best in America can be found in our biggest cities. Mm. And we don't take the time to look around and see those same people came out here because at one time, and probably it's still true, people were interested in having the best in their area.
We do tend to romanticize big cities. I mean, the way you described your views as a young student of thinking of New York, I've shared that. I have a son and daughter-in-law who are living in the South Loop in Chicago right now. Why do we romanticize it? Is it movies? Is it thinking of 40s movies and what New York looked like in black and white? Is that part of it?
That's part of it. We have those images from television, from the movies, I think from the books that we read. One of my favorite books when I was young was Marjorie Morningstar, which is by Herman Wouk. You probably mm-hmm. know him for War and Remembrance.
Right.
But this was a book that was written in the 50s about a girl growing up in the 30s. And it definitely romanticized New York. One of the things that I did when I moved to New York was go find the El Dorado apartments where Marjorie had lived in one of the towers and looked out at Central Park. But, you know, you do that once. You have that memory. Okay. You have that experience. And every time I go back to New York now, it only takes a half a day. And I feel like I'm back living in New York. Hmm. But I have the advantage of a garage. I have a garden. I have air conditioning. I don't have to share a wall with 30 other people. I have trees of my own. I don't have to go to the park to see the trees. So you find the things that matter to you in a big city, and then you bring them home with you.
So when you came back, which was when?
Well, I think I've moved back pretty much permanently. Oh. I joke with my friends that I might go and live in Italy, but I'm not going to move to Italy. So I came back for good at Christmas time this last Christmas.
And in your story, In Praise of Smaller Cities, you talk about looking at your small hometown of Ann Arbor, comparatively small, compared to New York and Tokyo and Chicago. What did you see with your new eyes after having lived in the big cities?
First of all, I think the thing that made me the most sentimental was I drove up to Gold Bond Dry Cleaners. And the ladies know me, and they brought my dry cleaning up to the front just because they saw my car drive up. No one in Chicago or New York is going to do that unless you're spending so much money at the dry cleaners that they know you. Another thing was walking into Zingerman's for breakfast, and there's Ari Weinzweig. And Ari gets up and gives you a hug. He's so glad to see you. And just sort of those sorts of things, the personal relationships, and you can have them in big cities. Absolutely. But it's harder. There are more of you and one of them, and it's a little bit more difficult. And what I found was that especially in big cities, money talks a lot louder. And so the folks that tend to get that kind of attention probably have a lot more money than I do. One of the other things that I noticed was that you get a nerd to this, but when I was living on Lakeshore Drive in Chicago, there was a lot of noise. There was noise from upstairs in my beautiful Bees Van Der Rohe apartment building. Someone who got up at 6 o'clock every morning. There were ambulances. There was a fire station nearby. And you get used to that when you live in a big city. But you come home to Ann Arbor and you're home. And the noises that you hear are maybe a dog and leaves falling off a tree and the kids talking to each other as they're walking home from middle school. And those are different kind of noises. And then at night, you might hear a bird, you might hear fireworks in the summer, but generally, it's pretty peaceful.
Michigan certainly has suffered the brain drain. And I guess, is that because the big city in Michigan is Detroit, and Detroit has been broken, and there's certainly hopes for it, but even though there is more of an influx of young people moving back downtown, it's not enough yet, I think, to draw our best and brightest.
Well, everybody has the feeling that, you know, the grass is greener on the other side. And so I would not keep anyone in the state of Michigan, anyone who grows up here, from going out and exploring the world. I certainly did. And I think that will eventually make them appreciate Michigan a lot more. But one thing I want to point out is Mario Batali, the famous chef. His wife is from Michigan, and a few years ago, he and his wife bought a big tract of land up north, up in the Leelanau Peninsula. Mm. And since then, they've become very, very active members of the community up there. They preserve some land that might have been lost to development. They now are singing the praises of northern Michigan to everyone in New York. And I just read an article that people from New York are now starting to come to northern Michigan because it's hip, because Mario came, and because I think it was Good Morning America said the Sleeping Bear Dunes is the prettiest spot in the country. And so sometimes it takes people from the outside to endorse what you have right in your backyard. And one of the things that I found in Chicago was I was basically replicating the life that I had in Ann Arbor. Only it took about four times as long, because you get stuck in traffic on surface streets in Chicago, or you sit there on I-90 and you're thinking, I could have been to the credit union and back by now. I can get, you know, to the farmer's market in 10 minutes. Why am I circling the block looking for parking? And so you, what I would recommend for anyone who's thinking, oh, gosh, I think I'm sick of Milwaukee or Chicago or Cleveland or whatever, maybe I'll move home to Michigan. Mm-hmm. One of the things I would ask people to do is decide what's really important to them. What do they have to have? Do they need access to good coffee? How important is walking to school for your kids? Do you want to be able to get out and walk the dog at all hours? What do you need in terms of movies? You know, we're not the number one movie market here. Mm-hmm. You get kind of jealous of Los Angeles and New York and Chicago for getting movies first. So sometimes you have to wait for a movie to get here. Property. I mean, this is not the cheapest place to live, although it's much cheaper than a big city. Mm-hmm. So I would make a list. I wouldn't just say, oh, I'm nostalgic for home, let me move home. And also you have to put the intellectual part of it in there. You know, you might live, not be from Michigan. You might be from the South or from another part of the country where you've lived on the East Coast. Your views maybe have changed. Folks back home, their views haven't. You know, you have to get along with people, and you have to decide, is that going to be comfortable for me as well?
The economic hardship in Michigan is what drove so many of our youngsters, once they graduated from college, to Chicago, elsewhere in New York, or going to college in Chicago, as in my son's case, and then just staying there. Things are picking up again. Do you think we may see some of these, the exodus be reversed, and we might see some of these younger families, young couples coming back to the roost?
I just spoke at a conference in Grand Rapids where talent is very much a big issue. Yeah. And the whole discussion was, how do we keep our talent in this area? And one of the suggestions that was made back when I was with Changing Gears, reports mm-hmm. that people heard on Michigan radio, was that if people have a reason to stay, if they're in college here and they've worked on a business with a professor, or they've started their own venture, or they join up with a local business, they might want to stay after graduation. So if you look at folks who are going to college here as people that you can tap into while they're here, that might be an incentive for them not to leave home or not to leave Michigan mm-hmm. in general. I am hoping that the economy will pick up a little bit more. But what I think is the solution is sort of these one-to-one relationships. And as we were saying earlier, it's easier to have a one-to-one relationship in a smaller place than it is in a bigger place. And that might be an advantage for smaller cities in Michigan.
I know Governor Snyder has got his common refrain is, would you want to be another yuppie in Chicago, or do you want to make a difference in Detroit? Is there a validity to that statement?
Absolutely. And I wouldn't probably live here if I wasn't from here. My feeling about my home state and my hometown are very, very strong. My family, my dad's family, is actually from the East Coast. And I feel strongly about the East Coast as well. But I'm glad to have roots here and roots there and be able to go back and forth. I do think you can make more of a difference as an individual in Detroit and in the surrounding area than you can among the millions of folks like you in Chicago. I think you'll have the company of millions of folks like you in Chicago, but you'll be blending in where here you might have the opportunity to stand out.
Thanks for talking with us, Mickey.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mickey Maynard wrote the article in praise of smaller cities for theatlanticcities.com, and we've put a link on our website at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered by Bob Scon. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. See you again tomorrow at 3:00.